Counsel, before you begin, however, we've got people coming in and out of the courtroom, so give us a second to get that accomplished. Thank you, Mr. Wrench. Then good morning to you and Mr. McElmeel, is that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Mack.
Good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed.
Thank you. And I'd like to reserve a minute for rebuttal. Thank you. Good morning to the court and counsel. I think when I decided to take this case on from the Volunteer Lawyers Project, I didn't realize that I was didn't plan to be in front of the Supreme Court. So, but it is an interesting case, and I think one thing I did not do in the briefing that is I think really important in a case like this one, and that is to have a good hypothetical. And sometimes an absurd hypothetical actually works best in this situation. I can get into all the facts again, but if, generally speaking, my client, she rented a car. She took it to Tennessee with her family. Her sister, who was with her, was told that she couldn't drive the car, but she took the car in the middle of the night surreptitiously and crashed the vehicle into another car that injured some folks, as a rental car from Avis. And so I ask you to consider this hypothetical as a backdrop, and that would be, instead of the injured parties, the plaintiffs down in Tennessee, we have David Domna wearing his new boots that he just purchased, and they were the same boots that Wild Bill Hickok was wearing when he was shot and killed in a bar in Deadwood. These boots he purchased at an auction for $600,000. He loves these boots. He's there because he's going to give a seminar to trial lawyers about how to give an oral argument, and he's the keynote speaker. He's standing on the curb. His boots are on. He loves his boots, and Miss McDavid, Sequoia, that's the sister of my client, is driving down the street, and literally a piece of space trash falls into the road in front of her. She swerves to avoid hitting this space trash, and she hits a puddle of water, but it also has some corrosive materials, and that water splashes up onto Mr. Domina's nice new boots, nice old boots. And he proceeds to make a claim. He makes a claim. He hires a lawyer in Tennessee. He files a lawsuit against Sequoia McDavid, the sister who took the car. Never files a lawsuit against Avis. His lawyer, though, is smart. He's trying to look for a way to get some money. And so he realizes that it's not going to work through Sequoia McDavid because it's become clear that she took the car without permission. There's probably not going to be any insurance coverage unless it's through the rental car company under a vicarious liability situation. So when he does this, he talks to Sedgwick, who is a third-party claims handler. And they do this for, you know, work comp cases. You guys have seen your honors have seen their names many times probably before this court on work comp claims. But they do this for all different kinds of claims and for giant corporations. Well, they decide, you know what, this is the agent who handles the case, this is a $600,000 claim, it's Dave Domna is the plaintiff, we're going to go ahead and just, I think we should just pay it. They write the check, they pay. Then Avis decides, you know what, we've got an indemnification language in our contract, we're going to go after this poor woman who rented our car to recover this $600,000 for these boots, because the boots are destroyed. It is an absurd...
This is very amusing. But
it is an absurd example.
But help me with the facts this case.
Right.
Is there anything in the record to suggest that any claim was ever asserted against Avis?
Well, you can only do it by presumption, by looking at the fact that there's a release signed that releases Avis from liability. Also, there's letterhead that has Avis and
The injured parties in Tennessee didn't sue Avis.
Absolutely not.
We don't have anything on our record that says that they made a demand on Avis.
No, it's all by presumption. That's
nobody
correct.
Brought Avis in as a third-party defendant.
Correct.
So, and your argument is Avis, for whatever reason, we don't know, their claims administrator voluntarily pays, correct?
Correct.
And your argument is it's voluntary because we have something called the Graves Amendment in federal law that says rental car companies can't be vicariously liable just because their car is involved in an accident.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Correct.
Yes. And so that's a big part of the argument. We also have ambiguity in the contract itself. And that was pointed out during the, not only in my brief to the court, to the trial court, at the motion to alter or amend hearing, but also during oral argument, when I talked about the Maynard case from Maine, okay? If you take a look at that case, you're going to see how Judge Woodcock went through an analysis, and you couldn't have found a factual scenario that was more similar to what we have here in this particular case. And his focus was on the word incur. And incur could mean a lot of different things, and I think we pointed that out in the briefing, that the way that it could be pay, right? But I think it is interesting that they use the word pay throughout the indemnification, or throughout the indemnification agreement, but also just throughout the contract in general, the rental agreement, okay? But the word incur and pay are both used all over the place. So, but incur is not defined. And I think it is pretty clear, and I did say this, and I'm sorry for repeating it, but it's from the brief, and that is that they can't mean the same thing.
What would legal dictionaries or case law tell us about what incur means?
Well, the ones that I pointed out in the brief are the ones that I know of, okay? And one of them is Black's Law Dictionary, which I think it said that you were subject, well.
There's some suggestion of liability, right? That you incur it if you are liable or legally obligated to make the payment.
Right, and that's the definition that we believe should be used in this particular case.
Because Avis was not liable or obligated to the injured parties in Tennessee.
That's correct, Your Honor. They were not liable, and they never could be liable under any circumstance whatsoever unless somehow their own employees or someone from Avis were the ones that actually caused the crash for some reason. But there's no fact like that before, in the record. So that's the whole point, is that it's a voluntary payment because they were never obligated to do it.
I want to circle back to my original question.
Sorry.
Is there anything in the record at all that shows why Avis was prompted to make this payment, or the claims settlement agent on Avis's behalf?
There is nothing direct is the best answer I can give, because all we have, Your Honor, is like any lawyer, you'd have to argue. Say yes. Look at this. We have
the inference from what you're arguing could cut either way, right?
Sure. It could cut either way. You're right. You're right, Your Honor. That's correct.
I think the answer ultimately is no. There's nothing in the record that shows why Avis was prompted to do what it did.
There is nothing in the record.
All right.
There's nothing in the record to show why they did it. In fact, the fact that they did it is still, I think, sometimes we do have to take things down to a common sense level. And this makes no sense. It just doesn't. And that's why I came here for the appeal. And I really think that this is a situation that, and it's been briefed, I just hope that the court will come our way, but I'm going to go ahead and hold off, if that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McElmeel, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew McMill, and I am counsel for Avis Rent-A-Car Systems. This matter before the court, as it comes to an appeal now, is that of a breach of contract case, more specifically a case of indemnity. We have three primary issues that have now made its way to this court. First is that of ambiguity. Opposing counsel, Ms. McDavid, has stated that the word incur included in the approximately 90-word indemnification and waiver provision has made it so ambiguous that the indemnification provision itself should be completely tossed out. When we look, however, at the indemnification and waiver provision in its entirety, Ms. McDavid is liable for any and all losses, liabilities, claims.
Is it your interpretation of the indemnification provision that by it, Ms. McDavid agreed to indemnify Avis if Avis chooses to make voluntary payments to injured parties for which Avis has no liability?
Your Honor, it's a great question because it leads down to the voluntary payment doctrine, which Ms. McDavid brings up. My client's stance on that point itself, the voluntary payment, is that it wasn't a voluntary payment. I mean, if we look at it generally in society, I typically don't pay somebody to the left of me if I'm not exposed to a potential liability or if I'm not liable to them.
What was the potential liability to Avis in this situation?
From the lawsuit itself, Your Honor, given the fact that they owned the car.
But they weren't sued.
They were not, Your Honor, but there was still the potential for that happening. My client saw that it a business necessity at that point in time to handle the claim then and there.
But do you disagree that the Graves Amendment, Mr. Wrench's position is that under the Graves Amendment, there's no possibility that Avis could have been liable? Do you disagree with that position?
I would entirely, Your Honor.
What's the authority?
The authority itself is the fact that we don't have a court, given the fact that the Tennessee court would have heard the Graves Amendment argument, that we can't definitively state that the Graves Amendment did apply. Mr. Wrench himself even said that, you know, there was the potential that the Graves Amendment didn't apply had there been a wrong negligence.
What if the Tennessee injured parties, their damages were $40,000 in medical damages, but instead they made a demand of you? This is sort of alluding to the Wild Bill Hickok's boots scenario maybe, but instead they make a demand for $400,000, and Avis decides, well, never know what a Tennessee court might do, we better cut the check. They cut a check for $400,000. Can they then turn around in Omaha and sue Ms. McDavid and say, we incurred this $400,000 because of your rental pay up?
Your Honor, I do believe it comes down to a business decision itself, the economics of litigation, the weight that goes into making these decisions themselves. Avis at that point in time found it a necessity based on the exposure that they have to this, given the fact that they owned the car that injured these three people.
What kind of exposure? I'm sorry to interrupt, but exposure just for what? Based on what legal liability? Or you keep calling it a business decision.
Yes, Your Honor.
Tie it to a statute or a precedent in Tennessee that we might not otherwise know about. I mean, what's the reason they paid?
And Your Honor, that's what I don't have specifically line item in front of me itself, nor the statutes of Tennessee lined in front of me to provide that to you.
Assume that there's Tennessee case law that says there's no vicarious liability for the owners of rental cars if the rental car is in an accident. What does that do to your argument?
If we want to, at that point in time, say specifically that if I own a rental car and that if it's used in any accidents, then the rental car company is foregone. However, in the Graves Amendment itself, we do have two preceding subsections that require analysis and then require ruling by a court to say that there was no wrongdoing on behalf of Avis, and that Avis did.
What's the basis for liability here? What is the basis for Avis being liable to the injured parties?
In this instance, none. But it was generally the exposure itself to the liability.
So this is an
exposure to invisible liability? What is that?
Your Honor,
that's what we're trying to get to the bottom of.
Is this just a risk analysis and someone says it's easier to cut to check than litigate?
That would be an assessment, Your Honor.
Avis's tolerance may be different than Ms. McDavid's tolerance of risk? $40,000 to her may be different than $40,000 to Avis.
Agreed, Your
Honor. So based on those differences, is it okay to, you say this isn't worth the risk, we're going to settle it, and now we're going to charge Ms. McDavid for that $40,000. Is that appropriate?
I think in this instance itself, when you have a driver that is involved in an accident that is liable and was helped so in that instance, then you have the exposure of Avis, given the fact that they do own the car. We don't know what would happen further on. See, I mean, today the litigation could still be going on from that matter itself. Well, Avis might have been pulled into it, and the economics behind it itself
that
might not have
circles back to the question I asked your opponent, and I want to ask you if you agree with him that there is nothing in this record to show that any claim, demand, or request, or anything of that nature was made upon Avis to pay money.
We don't have anything in the record, Your Honor.
Oh, so you agree with his characterization of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If we change the hypothetical just quickly here and says Avis made a mistake in paying, could they turn and then try to recoup the money, even if it was Avis's mistake in making the payment?
In this instance, yes, Your Honor. I would say I would fully agree with that assessment itself, given the fact that when we do look at the contract that was signed between...
You're saying yes, if they paid it by mistake, Avis can still look to Ms. McDavid for the payment?
When we look at this contract, yes, Your Honor. I would assess that when we look at the indemnification and waiver provision in its entirety, if it would fall within one of the, I think it's phrased, losses, liabilities, damages, injuries, claims, demands, awards, costs, attorney's fees, and other expenses that were incurred in any manner, that would also include that. Now, if we bring that to the court, then it would be the court to decide whether or not Avis at the time actually did lose something or was liable or damaged, incurred. But under that assessment, suit would still be proper.
So ultimately, isn't your position that the language of the Avis contract permits voluntary payments to be pursued?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the contract itself, that would be an appropriate assessment. However, we can't say that the payment made by Avis was voluntary, given the fact that there was exposure to their business from where they sat as owner of the vehicle.
Hypothetically, apparently.
Exposure based on what? Cite me to a statute or a case. Exposure based on what?
That's what I don't have for
you. Just generalized anxiety about litigation?
I mean, just... Your Honor, the best way I could describe it for the court is I'm typically not going to pay the person to my left if I'm not either exposed to liability for something somebody did or I'm liable to them directly.
Except that it looks like that's maybe exactly what Avis did here. Yeah, I think we understand that parties don't normally do that. We're asking, what's the basis? to show that that wasn't what happened here.
Your Honor, could you rephrase that for me?
Well, I think it's been asked before, but I mean, can you point us to any theory of liability by which a Tennessee court would order Avis to pay damages to the injured parties?
That's what I don't have for you, Your Honor. I mean, if Avis was brought into the Tennessee court, Avis at that potential had the opportunity to present to the court Graves Amendment. However, that didn't happen in the court. We don't have anything before us here today that says the Graves Amendment does apply, rubber stamp and seal. And so we can't say that the Graves Amendment does apply. We can't talk about the ifs and maybes of the legal strategy in Tennessee, but what we can talk about here today is the loss incurred by Avis and the contract that we do have with Ms. Davidson. Any further questions, Your Honor? If not, I'll let you be. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
45 seconds, Your Honor.
45 seconds, Mr. Wrench.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think one thing we want to look at, just to follow up on the end of that questioning and answer, was I cited the Martin case in Tennessee, which I think makes it very clear that there's no way that Avis could have been found liable in any way, and that all it would have taken, if they did ultimately get sued, which we know they did not get sued, would have been taken care of on a motion to dismiss. And that was clear from the record. Another thing is, if the court has to get to this extent, which I don't think they need to, but if they do, public policy would say that, you know, we shouldn't be here signing rental contracts to fix mistakes that the person who writes the contract makes. That's not something that a customer should have to take care of. I think it's pretty general. And finally, I just want to say thanks to my then 13-year-old daughter who helped format my brief in a hotel room during a softball tournament in Columbus, Nebraska at like 11 o'clock at night.
Did she get the font right?
She was amazing. I wanted to hire her, but she's a little young. So thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Avis Rent-A-Car System, Inc. versus McDavid. And you are excused.
Thank you.
And thank you. The next case of the day, then, is Core Bank versus Allied Construction Services. Justice Papik is recused from this matter, and the court will be joined by District Court Judge Jacobson.